Hello, hello, and welcome to the 27th Metroplex City Podcast. For those, you know, keeping track at home, that is 3 cubed, so pretty sweet number. I will eventually get into a range where I won't have anything interesting to say about numbers at all, which is really kind of unfortunate. Like, what do you say about, like, 57? I mean, there's just not a lot going on there. But I'm sure that, you know, in response to this, someone will be like, actually, you know, 1957, this cool thing happened. And then I'll know. But in the meantime, I'm a fan of 3 cubed. It's in a, you know, small but sweet club with, you know, like 4 and 256 and so forth. So we'll take that one for what it's worth. Got a lot of questions. I've sort of had a theme for this thread. If you're not following along on the forums, I've been working a lot on Old Town and an event that's hopefully coming up, and we'll. So I haven't been, you know, keeping up with just sort of the, you know, once a week, once every other week, sort of little updates that I try to do. So I opened the floor, so to speak, to see what people might want to see in some of those little updates, because I'm very much, I've got the tunnel vision going on, so we'll see. I had a couple ideas with that, but we'll see if folks can jar me out of that, or if we're just gonna follow right on through until the event comes in. Alright, first off, we've got a couple questions from Barton. The going rate for unearthly coins is somewhere between 35,000 and 40,000 credits in Omnimal. This translates to be around 7,500 credits per US dollar. The best credit farmers can currently earn about 12,000 credits a day, $1.60. What would you consider the optimal exchange rate to be? Should it be higher or lower? It's actually a lot better than I would expect. This is going to sound incredibly arrogant, but that would strongly imply that I did a very good job designing the game. Almost, like, possibly erring towards there being too much stuff to do, but that's not really, I mean, you know. Oh, no, there's too much stuff to do in my game. Like, that's definitely whatever the opposite of damning with faint praise is. Exulting with faint criticism, I guess. That sounds fantastic. I mean, what I would sort of be like, this is what I would shoot for. I would say, any time less than, like, 2/3 of a month to, you know, get the month's item, it's probably fine. Probably half's better than that, so you can spend, you know, half your time farming and half your time doing something else. And really, like, I don't think that anything truly, honestly breaks down until you get substantially over a month. Because, you know, you can set out some stuff like that. And seeing as how our average month is, you know, 750, roughly, right? And you're looking at that being about 5 days. I don't really think that there's much of a downside to that. To me, that implies just that people are, valuing their playtime very highly, which is not a bad thing, right? So the people who are spending their playtime, farming are getting a pretty good deal, out of what they're doing, which is, I think, A-okay. Is it possible to hit the max integer value for items credits in your inventory in Metroplexity, or is it some insanely high number? As I recall, stored item values is a 32-bit integer, meaning the maximum was about 4 billion. I believe, don't quote me on this, but I believe that's how we have it set for items, and then credits is 64-bit. But, like I said, don't quote me on that. Obviously there's always going to be some sort of theoretical upper limit, at least in any of the normal ways of storing integers. Like, there are some weird things you could do to get around it. Probably not worth the time or effort involved. Like, you could con SQL into storing them as text or something, but that just seems insane. But, yeah, in any normal storage method, it'll eventually cap out. But yeah, it's just a matter of choosing an absurdly high number for it to cap out at. I don't think anyone's gotten anywhere near, from either a items or credits perspective. Suggestion, would it be possible to get a longer new sellers, new buyers list? Like maybe an option that just says expand, allow you to see the last 20 or something? Just a thought. I could probably do that. Probably do something like 25 just to be saucy, but let me write that down before I forget. Oops, that is the wrong document. You'll totally have to listen to me talking to myself for a second. Don't mind the crazy person talking to himself about stuff. Being annoyed at Word, because Word is terrible. It's like, you know, if you're a word processing program, I would expect, you know, as a real baseline, to be able to render text consistently, rather than, like, just randomly deciding to not include chunks of the document you're displaying. If you're feeling generous, got any tips for that amulet content? I'm still trying to decipher your last clue. No, I think we're good. There have been a lot of old mysteries progress since the last podcast, so I'm not feeling too concerned about it. There are a couple of pretty sweet things to do regarding the amulet still, but we'll see how that all turns out. Alright, some questions from Penguin Pyro. According to him, lots of nitpicky questions, so this should be interesting. Alright, first off, does the Blackstone composition of various amounts of gameplay or plot significance, or is it just flavor? I mean, it has gameplay significance, sort of, I think. It's sort of a heads-up to various things about the monster that have gameplay significance. It's not like, they're not flagged as, like, Blackstone in the database or anything, but, it's the sort of thing that I would probably pay attention to. It has more plot significance than that, though. There's sort of I'm sure that you've noticed going through, if you're talking about, like, the ghost ship, enemies there have a sort of theme and a sort of approach that works with them, and the the ghouls have sort of a theme and approach that works with them. And if, as I am sort of implying, there are other categorizations like that. So when you start to see like a grouping of ideas or creatures from an etheric perspective, at least, there's probably some plot significance to it, rather than just being like, nothing. Most human opponents have negative etheric defense. Any reason? Could it be linked between confidence and etheric defense, or that they're unaware of the etheric world? Sort of two different directions with that. One of them is definitely etheric defense is related to, confidence and just generally having, your mental shit together. Which, this might not speak well to my opinion of humanity, but it would tend to, they tend to not. Some of it also has to do with the sort of people that you're dealing with. The bums and the third eye people, and, the people on campus, aren't necessarily always sterling examples of humanity, particularly when it comes to keeping their brains on lockdown. And there's basically two different things overlapping that etheric defense can represent. One of them is just sort of I would call it self-image, almost, like you, basically what I was talking about, like having your shit together. And if you have your shit together enough, you'll have a pretty good etheric defense, and, you know, vice versa. And the other aspect is sort of using etheric things to fight etheric things, which you'll see with, like, you know, I forget which direction, like, the third eye sorcerer goes, but if you were to fight, like, hell, would actually be an example. If you were fighting hell, and you were using etheric powers, which would not do very much. And, obviously, there are other people who are using, similar, approaches, you know, out through, like, the third eye and Midgard and so forth. Although the third eye tends to go a little bit in the other direction, in the lower ranks. They sort of worry about opening the door first and then installing the locks later, if that makes any sense. Why do Slyx guards have needlers and normal Midgard security doesn't? The Slyx guards are, sort of a subdivision, but they're more under internal security. The normal Midgard security you're running into on, like, you know, Metroplex DU's campus aren't Midgard's ass-kickers, really. And even the ones you run into with, like, the Southside lab, they are more just the punch clock dudes. But when you start running into their internal security guys, like the Slags guards, and particularly, I mean, you're going to end up downtown eventually, and it's reasonable to expect that, you know, at least some players will certainly end up getting into fights with the Midgard security down there, and they are not fucking around, and they would definitely have needlers. But yeah, it's just like a pay and prestige thing, right? Like, if you're you know, starting out, you know, junior security officer Bob, that's not really trusted and trained completely yet, you know, you might be sent to, you know, bum-nap some people, but you're not being trusted to actually guard the company's most secure facilities, which, I mean, obviously when you're looking at the as the lab in Southside Park saying this isn't one of Midgard's most secure facilities, that should tell you something in of itself, but that's not a story faux pas. It's they have other facilities that are much more under lock and key, and that's where you'd start to find people like the head of security at the Southside Lab is obviously, you know, a class above, so to speak, special case of sorts, but you would see guys outfitted more like him, and they would tend to have, you know, needlers, cybernetics, whole nine yards, especially once you start getting to, like, you know, the guys who are guarding headquarters and other extremely secure facilities. Why are gas grenades so much weaker than punching? Well, they're nominally non-lethal. Obviously, like, it doesn't always work out that way. But they are intended to subdue more than kill. And sort of scare people off. And, you know, it doesn't always work out that way. Wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if I coded in some responses to that from some of the campus people. Not sure that's going to happen. But yeah, no, it's just I mean, you're basically getting someone with a amped up tear gas grenade rather than punching them in the face. And like, if you were to, you know, like you definitely can kill someone with a tear gas grenade, particularly if you're, you know, using a launcher rather than just, you know, throwing them. But even then, like, you know, not as non-lethal as the folks who make them, or hopefully the folks who make them or folks that use them would like. But there's just a lot more chance for stuff to go wrong when you're punching people. Why do not security guards drop batons despite only shooting? Well, I mean, they obviously don't have to, you know, drop batons, but they do tend to carry them. I mean, as much as a, you know, symbol of purpose or rank, as an actual, you know, tool to use in combat. I noticed there's a lot of references to gold's inexplicable appeal despite the economic situation in Metroplexity. Any plot significance? Not... Well... I mean... it's not saying there that, like, gold's appeal is connected to the ether. There's just not... Not really a ton of use for the stuff anymore. It's, I mean, it's sort of like the commentary on petrol, used to be really valuable, now is mostly, replaced by various electrical components, right? But people still like gold because people are people. And there's sort of that tradition factor that I think is inexplicable in its own special way. There, you've sort of got the truly inexplicable, right? Like all of these things coming out of the ether and so forth. But when push comes to shove, like, mystery is still other people in a lot of ways. And I think that that's one of the ones that, yeah. And that sentence dropped off. But, why so little good swimming gear? We can find wetsuit fabrics and rebreather masks, so someone must be swimming. Yes, some people were swimming. That's not... that didn't just, you know, get down there by itself. But there is so little good swimming gear because you're not really anywhere where there are a lot of, you know, humans currently swimming. or the sort of place that would, you know, sell or supply diving gear. There is not a lot of demand for diving into Lake Metroplex, so if you had access to, like, you know, a Caribbean island or something that, like, was sort of its zone over there, you could definitely buy some sweet swimming gear, you know, snorkels and all of this happy stuff, and, you know, little propulsion things that you hold on to. I'm blanking on what they're called, but those are pretty cool for deep diving. You know, some there's a lot that cybernetics can do for diving. That's pretty interesting. But it just if, you know, in the future, in some later part of the game, you were to run into an area with you know, diving culture, or, like, an active diving scene, whether that's, you know, a villain's, you know, evil underwater base, or, you know, a aforementioned Caribbean resort island, I would not be surprised to find substantially better diving gear. But you're sort of at the south side, like, equivalent of diving gear, if that makes sense. Hopefully. Did you choose 1984 country names Oceania and Eurasia for flavor, or is there some greater significance? I like the reference, but I also like that it sort of implies that national borders have largely broken down. That you have a handful of extremely large nations, and sort of a double handful of tiny, tiny little nations, right? And I think that that fits very well with the future that we're sort of describing in Metroplexity. The corporations, you know, have largely stepped in for the nation states, and that has resulted in the sort of mixture that you see there. The you have the large states that sort of have the competition between multiple corporations, and then you have a lot of smaller states that are basically completely controlled by an individual corporation, that sort of thing, or are just sort of nexuses of ridiculous, like, corporate intrigue. Like Hong Kong, places like that, are sort of the sort of, like, gateway micro-states are very, very different places from Metroplex. Not necessarily in a good way. In that people in Metroplex, I mean, they're sort of like Midgard and then everybody else, right? But at least, like, if you're a Midgard employee, you only really have to worry about your bosses at some level. Or, you know, crazy PCs busting into your lab and shooting you in the face. But in somewhere like Hong Kong, there's a lot of really vicious competition, in the sense that, like, you know, if you're doing something in Hong Kong, like, it's either almost like a East Berlin sort of spying situation, like East Berlin, West Berlin sort of spying situation, or you are a small company that's walking a very, very dangerous tightrope over a pool of sharks and possibly, like, death shrimp or something. So, yeah. Similarly, Hound Drones, Fahrenheit 451, or Hounds of the Baskerville reference, or are they just there? I do not remember Hound Drones in Fahrenheit 451. I might have to reread that. Yeah, not a purposeful Fahrenheit 451 reference. It actually is a purposeful reference type thing. In that they are inspired by the Tintalosi, the Hounds of Tintalos, from Lovecraft's work. Obviously, they play out much differently, but they... Well, I guess that's not really the Hound Drones, right? That's the... that's the Twisted Hounds themselves. And the Hound Drones are sort of... Well, actually, backing up several steps to answer your actual question, the Hound drones are actually this is kind of great. They're not exactly a reference to the AIBO, A-I-B-O, I think it's pronounced AIBO, but whatever, like the little Sony dog thing, but are intentionally sort of tapping into the same idea. Like, people, as a commercial product, I think, if you are going to sell a autonomous defense robot, right, you basically have two options. You either dress it up like a security guard, which I think is not the appropriate, like, way to do that. Like, I don't think that you would, you know, sell a lot of, you know, creepy, uncanny valley, you know, security androids, right? Like, that's just a whole world of bad marketing waiting to happen. Or you go with dogs, right? Like, you make them look like dogs. And so that's sort of where that's coming from. So, the appearance is very slightly modeled after the AIBO, as I recall. But, the idea is actually from an in-world perspective. Like, they're, the main line of, Midgard defensive drones they, like, sell outside the company, are the Hound drones, for exactly the reason that I just gave. Ship of the Damned Quest is the ghost. Okay, zombie, same difference. I'm the navigator and Iron Maiden reference. I am not familiar with that Iron Maiden song, so probably not. Now that specific part of the quest, I don't feel is a like really specific reference to anything. I mean, sort of the quest as a whole is obviously like a reference to a body of, you know, nautical and zombie-like thought, right? That I feel gets sort of, like, sadly underrepresented now. Like, the more the zombie thing sort of grows, the more I'm glad that, like, that's in there. Just because, like, I don't know, like, we've got, you know, you know, virus zombies and drug zombies and more and more and more virus zombies. And it's like, I don't know. And, like, they're sort of like the, like, D&D necromancer zombies you, I'm assuming, are probably getting in Diablo 3. I don't even know if they have necromancers in there. I have not played Diablo 3 at all yet. Don't have any particular intention to, which is sort of unfortunate, but you'll have that. But the, I think that the actual, like, original zombie myths have a lot of really cool flavor to them. That has really sort of been abandoned in the modernization. I mean, like, there's sort of, like, the D&D style ones, which, I mean, are sort of the zombie myth with the serial numbers filed off, right? But I kind of liked the serial numbers. the modern zombie sort of mythos, right, like the World War Z, which is a fine book, don't get me wrong, I really enjoyed that book, but sort of that approach, I think, is missing a lot of, like, the element that made zombies cool. Why does while shooting with cover fire deal so much damage? I would have to look at that. I would have to look over that code to see exactly. Any reason why Dave the Hipster's asked special consideration for Midgard security? They don't seem to give much of a damn about what happens to the students. If tolerating the worst punks is any consideration. The I think that you will find that Midgard's security response on Metroplex U's campuses is always going to be really disproportionate for a variety of reasons. Their motivations are only very moderately, like, keeping the peace, right? Like, they're not about crime and punishment. They're not even really, like, hired to be about crime and punishment. They're really hired to, I mean, keep stuff down to a dull roar, certainly, but that's not really the main reason why they're there. If you thought through the main reason why they're there, some of their responses make a lot more sense. Yeah. I understand this is a new utopia, but why is the Metro U set up like a war zone at this point? Between the Herald of Fire, Happy Hour Brawls, Missing Artist, Quad Psycho, Crazy Magic Bombs, Third Eye Violence, Midgard Police Brutality, the Punk Uprising, and of course, Up's bloodthirsty, psychotic player characters, the student seems surprisingly relaxed and complacent sorts. I mean, to some extent, like, that's split up. And you also, the Midgard security folks and the students, to a large extent, don't really care about intergang violence. And that includes, like, the punks. And, like, when the punks start killing, like, you know, random, fairly harmless-seeming students, that's a bigger deal. But when, like, you, as an assumed crazy gang member person, start killing punks, like, they don't really care. And I think, as far as, like, the Herald of Fire and some of the other stuff goes, I think that, there are extra answers to be found there, in some of the Halloween content. Will Old Town have ninjas? I would be pretty surprised if you met a ninja in Old Town. To the best of my knowledge, there are not currently ninjas in Old Town. But, you know, with how ninjas operate, that probably means that there are ninjas in Old Town. So, I guess the real question there is, will we notice the ninjas in Old Town, right? To which the answer is probably not. You probably will not notice the ninjas in Old Town. Why does Omnitech need special forces? They just make stuff, I thought. Surely they can rely on hired guns when it comes down to force. Omnitech does not believe in outsourcing. if that makes any sense. They are basically completely integrated. Which is why they have their own special forces. Admittedly, they probably would anyway. I mean, when you're talking about internal security and sending out, like, you know, people to blow shit up, it really just does not pay. Assuming you have enough work for them to actually keep people on hand, and, you know, the resources, right, to keep people on hand, you really want to just keep them on hand. You don't want to outsource that stuff. I would actually go so far to say that as much as an IT person, like, I really don't think that outsourcing tech support ends up being a very good idea in the long run. I would say that that's still a much better idea than outsourcing your people to kill people. But yeah. Midgard scientists are arguably better armed than their attendant guards. I'm pretty sure it's against common sense as well as lab safety to regularly carry around explosives, acid, neurotoxin syringes, poison sprays, and wrenches at the same time. So why do they? I would imagine that they are... Well, I guess there are two reasons there. One of them is, you may have noticed, but they're not entirely stable most of the time. I mean, I know that that's, you know, really stretching, you know, that's totally a dig on their science folks, but little loopy. Just saying. But that aside, I sort of imagine that a lot of that is them grabbing stuff from their environment. Because, I mean, you can find most of those things just sort of scattered around, right? They're just sort of attacking you with whatever they have on hand. Which, I mean, admittedly ends up making it look like a lot of things. And, like, if I were ambitious, I would, like, generate the stuff that they have on hand each time, and then they would attack based on that, but that just does seem like a very good use of time, because it would not be particularly noticeable, right? I mean, they would just eventually, you know, degenerate into punching you in the face, but it would take quite a while for that to happen, so it would be basically unnoticeable in most combats. Like, it's codable, but there is basically an endless amount of death-dealing equipment in there, so I don't feel too bad with it working the way it is. Some questions from Al. Will the puzzle box be rotating back in once we've had 12 seasons? Yes, it'll be rotating back in for, I guess, it would be season 13, right? In my brain, that's, season 25, just because it's numbered based on, you know, which item numbered it, right? So, it would display as 13, be, coded as 25. How's Old Town going? Upcoming events? ! I'm not going to promise the upcoming event. I may still have to put it out of its misery, but I think that there will be an upcoming event, but I'm not going to discuss it a ton, because if I don't end up doing it, there would be sadness and disappointment, etc. Old Town is coming along pretty nicely. Things are well mapped out. I just need to fill in, like, a pretty ridiculous amount of content still. There's that. It's shaping up to be a lot of fun, though, so there's that. Unlockable titles? I could very easily, do unlockable titles. I would have to think about them some, but that's definitely not a, not an out-of-the-question sort of thing. Pets? Pets are sort of, larger scale than I really have time for right now. They will eventually happen, and I still have art for them, and it's still staring at me with its adorable eyes, and I don't look in that folder very often. Any hints on what to do with the collapsed integrator? I can't find anything on electronic site, software site, Professor Emmons, Midgard Labs, old bookshelves, or anywhere else. Unless I did something very, very wrong, you will feel kind of silly when you figure it out. Because I think in practice it really should be the first thing that you think of. So, I'll just leave that, I guess, as nominally we spent a lot of time in Arch finding out cool new messages from mirror gazing. Are we close to fully understanding the skill, or is there something missing, still something significant? Are we missing a fundamental mechanic of it, or just a few more messages from the remaining opponents we haven't tested? You're definitely doing a lot better looking at the page. I mean, there's some stuff that you won't actually be able to fully do at the moment. Like, there's some sort of along the lines of the questions of, like, you know, what happens when I have both, you know, Bay Eyes and Ocean Eyes, that type of thing. Is there a hacking avatar and any hints on what you need to do to unlock it? Wearing mimetic gear in Game Warfare didn't seem to do the trick. There's not at the moment. I should probably put one in there as part of the hacking reward scheme. It would probably not involve mimetic gear. Although that's kind of funny. I mean, like, I will cheerfully put in things rewarding you for, you know, wearing weird things in PvP, like the fishing avatar, but I feel like there's probably an opening for a legitimate, just, like, balls-out hacking challenge. Are we missing many effects that are from when PvP opponents use techniques against you, numbing neurotoxin from striking shield, for example? We've only found a small handful, but I imagine they're not very well spaded since they require PvP cooperation. Well, I mean, they don't really require PvP cooperation exactly. They just require, you know, using the correct techniques, and then someone being like, holy shit, this happened, and putting it on the forums, right? I don't think there's anything that's like, you know, if I use stunning shield, striking shield, and you use, you know, Jacob's ladder or whatever, then, you know, something magical happens. Admittedly, I won't say for sure that there's nothing like that. I don't think that most of those would end up being buffs. But yeah, there's at least one of those that I was expecting to be found, but when the content rolled out, it was like, oh yeah, nobody's actually, like, with the way that people are using this content, nobody's actually going to find it. And there are probably several other of those that I'm just not thinking about at the moment. Overall, there are quite a few, so if you found, like, you know, three or four, I'd imagine there are about three or four more. I know for sure I'm thinking of at least one. But, yes, it's not here and there. A few questions about the Hungry Ooze. There seem to be some items that are blacklisted from being fed. Most of these make sense to be blacklisted. Unearthly items, quest items, some old holiday roar, etc. But there are a few more that don't stir up for any reason I can see. Notably, the protest sign, navigator's glasses, and stone spider leg. Are these hinting at anything? Why can't we feed them? I think that you honestly could probably figure that out looking at the items. I mean, there's sort of a common factor there, but there's not a particular flag. There's something that I think if you just stared at them, that would start making a lot of sense. There is not a particular blacklist. That's what I'm saying there. Why does a quivering rifle give the bizarre configuration message, but not the quivering needler? I think that if you paid attention and answered the previous question, this one might also start making sense. Is it conditional how many turns of ooze symbiosis we get, or is it random? It is at least partially conditional. If I recall correctly, and this is, I mean, a pretty old item, obviously, if I recall correctly, it is completely discernible from stuff that you're seeing, if that makes sense, but is... Yeah, like, there are all of the variables are out there. It's just a matter of, I mean, one of the variables is visible at random, and one of the variables is neither visible nor random. and then they combine to make a number that is probably not your dreams, now that I think about it. I apologize already if I totally am misremembering how that works, but I'm pretty sure that's a fairly accurate, if completely vague, description. Some questions from Aranoth. Would you be willing to remove the encounter to leave a clone in an empty zone when you will not actually leave one? Right now, it just wastes energy and discourages participation in game raid warfare. I can make that not cost energy. I can't actually make that, not show up. Or, I mean, I could, but it would be way more work than it's worth. Last podcast, you implied that cybernetics would be best if they're customized. So it would be possible in Old Town with access to fancier toys, either generated based on what we use, a smuggler, or perhaps even with player design your own piece, missing costs and advantages somehow, with slot-based limits and possibilities. There is slightly more chance for, like, choosing stuff from drop-down to cybernetics, but I would never expect that to show up for anything ever. Just as a general rule. I'm not sure if you play Kingdom of Loathing or Twilight Heroes, but you'll hear very much the same response from them, because the items work very similarly. If something is... Each item of a given type is basically exactly the same. It's not that you can have, like, you know, a pair of cyber eyes with, like, you know, something from a drop down. Like, you have a drop down list and you choose which pair of cyber eyes you want, if that makes sense. So if the options become complicated at all, each choice is its own item. So if you have, I mean, like the custom weapon from the smuggler, I mean, each of those is, each, you know, cell in that sort of grid, right, is its own item. And if we're talking about customizable cybernetics, that would... using any sort of system like that, it would end up being just a ton of items, typically. And that's, yeah, it's really just the easiest way to do it. The other thing you'd have to do is just, like, code in a check to, like, a separate table that lets you know. Which you'll see them do in... Unless it's in Twilight Heroes, but they'll do in Kingdom of Loathing sometimes, like the, I'm thinking of the Necklace of Petrified Bone Teeth from the Fossil Event. You know, it has, like, a bunch of different bonuses based on what teeth are on it, but the teeth are actually stored in, you know, a separate table somewhere, and then it's pulling that data over to adjust, your characteristics, when you equip it. Downside with that is it really, basically, if you can avoid doing that, it, like, that's just a lot of SQL calls that you have to do whenever that item is, you know, equipped, unequipped, it recalculates, you know, and a lot of times you can't even just, you know, leave well enough alone sometimes, right? Like, you need to, if, for example, well, in Metroplexity, for the most part, it would, that's sort of why it would work better with cybernetics, because I can't speak for Kingdom of Loathing's code, but, it's sort of partitioned off, like, every time you screw around with your cybernetics, it recalculates what your cybernetics do. Every time you screw around with your equipment, it recalculates what your equipment do. And then it goes through and does a round of checks over everything, so you get stuff like um, there we go. Like the effects on equipment that only work when you have etheric power. I'm sorry, not etheric power. If you only have etheric active, right? Like on the best helmet in the world, and the imaginary spear, and stuff like that. How much mystery is left in the spelunking helmet? It is, I would say, mostly spaded. I mean, there's obviously a lot going on there, and some interrelations, but, like, the majority of, like, the text is visible. I'm not sure if you've gotten all the techniques out of it yet. I would have to go over and double-check that. After that came out, I was pretty distracted for a while, with some, between, like, Old Town and, well, all of the stuff that I talked about in the opening of the question thread. Are there any hidden avatars with a crown? Since I haven't found a cyborg avatar, a royalty avatar seems like it wouldn't be that unreasonable with the gear available in many potential cases of regicide in this game. I don't think at present, there's one that I've been saving that is kind of royalty. Not really. But yeah, I guess to answer your question, there are not any that have crowns in the art that I'm aware of, and I would be aware of them. So yeah. Some questions from Volvo. To get the ball rolling, I have some questions about the feathered cloak. More specifically, there are some things I'd like to know a little more about Raven's eyes. First, given the possible cascade so far, it seems reasonable to speculate that melee and or evasion cascades could exist. I mean, if you found a 5 and 6 or 8 and 9 chain value melee, which I doubt will ever happen, are there techniques that can bridge a cascade without disrupting it, or am I now on the hunt for some new melee or evasion techniques? If you're on the hunt for melee techniques that are 5, 6, or 8, 9, I think you probably should stop that hunt, because that's sort of the exact opposite of melee techniques. Third, the interaction with Reika Dodge and Tendrils has me wondering if there are any specialized cascades lurking around, or is that a unique case? They're, in a specific sense with the Raven's Eyes, I'd have to double-check. In a broader sense, there are just a lot of techniques that do stuff like that. That's not a weird one-off for the Raven's Eye. That's, just happens on top of the existing cascade. Quick question about the Hawk's Talons. Compared to the other Texture and Cloak, this gets really overshadowed. Is there some interesting use of the trigger that we're missing, or is it just a vanilla melee attack? I'm guessing there's probably something interesting that you're missing, because I don't think that it's probably just a melee attack using perception, because there are a couple of those. Double check here. Mm-hmm. Always possible that something is broken. I haven't thought about this in, like, for ages. No. There definitely is some... yeah, there's some cool stuff going on there. As you can tell from the cackle, I guess. Bonus cloak question. Are we any closer to the feathered cloak avatar, or is there still a long way to go? You are definitely closer than the last time this question was asked, yes. Not so much a question as a thank you. With feather cloak chains, thanks for having the Owl Raven Raven and Hawk Raven Raven chains work the way they do. It certainly makes getting the text work most of the way. You are very welcome. Moving on to the Midgard player. When using the various recordings that produces, there is a bonus XP gained if the recording you use matches the base seed you have playing. Curious if the tapping along message for the first recording is just some flavor text, or is there more in play beyond the XP bonus? There is quite a bit going on with Tempest recordings, as I recall. Oops. So going to totally the wrong set of files. Now the part is, I wonder where, finding the code that actually does this, don't mind me. Whoa! Okay, that's cool as hell how he treated that. Don't mind me at all. Okay, sorry, I had completely forgotten the giant chunk of stuff involved in the recordings, don't mind me. There's, there are a number of interactions going on there. One of which might lead you to discover fabulous things that I had totally forgotten about that I was just sucked into reading. I'm sorry, I should have just paused in the recording there. Next up is the Ragman's Cape. Are there any other techniques that interact with it, like the Raven's Eyes? Yes, are they as awesome as the Murderous Barrage of Ravens? I don't think that you can top Murderous Barrage of Ravens. That's an unfairly high bar for awesome. I want to say there's another one that it's related to, but you haven't found yet. It would not surprise me if there were some others around, though. I tend to sort of go with themes, and if there's anything that just thematically seems like it should interact like that. And it's not even necessarily always, like, a huge bonus. Sometimes I just, drop in a little bit of text there, maybe make it, a little higher damage or whatever. Or make it into some, incredibly convoluted puzzle that nobody will ever actually find, let alone figure out. I've been known to do that, too. Just wondering if you might be willing to give a hint or two about the remaining thing on the red lensed goggles. Could it have anything to do with the shipwrecks we can fish up or the genius behind the Eternal Sparklers? Eternal Sparklers is a genius. Kind of the best idea ever. I would totally get an Eternal Sparkler, even if it was pretty expensive. Let's see. It will require some pretty keen eyes, and some definite experimentation to figure out the last thing. Far be it for me to be like, don't try too hard. But I think there are sort of like, I probably said this last time too, but there are clues there and they're faint enough that I didn't put them in there expecting, like, necessarily for anyone to find them for quite a while. With knowing how much my obvious hints can sometimes be frustrating, I wouldn't necessarily focus on that with laser-like determination. That may just be something that somebody figures out, being like, wait a second, like, why are there, like, four there instead of two? That seems kind of weird. Last question, I promise. It has to do with the Extreme Tackle Box. Recently, I've been keeping track of my results, and I'm curious to know if I'm on the right track. With no lines or lures active, I've been receiving an active of one lure for every six trips. With just an extreme lure active, I've seen my average increase to one lure every three trips. I know I still need more data for both these scenarios, and to check every possible one, but I'm wondering if I'm approaching this the right way. There is. I mean, there's definitely a relation between the number of trips and what it's coming out with. I would imagine that's probably pretty well settled by now. And there's some fairly complicated interrelations. I would. I'm not honestly sure offhand if one of those is whether you already have a lure active, whether you already have an extreme lure active. It would be strange from a design perspective for me to give you more lures when you already have lures. That's not the way I usually roll. If anything, I don't think that it needs diminishing returns in this case, but if anything, that's usually the direction I go if I'm paying attention to, like, if you're already using it. Like, if, you know, if you've already gotten a ton of lures. Well, I guess it's possible, but I don't remember doing anything like this. It wouldn't surprise me if it were something like, you know, if it's dropped, you know, a bunch of, you know, extra lures this run, deviate towards, like, of a specific lure, right? Deviate towards some of the others, stuff like that. But, I don't think that's one of the relations. An Andrew side quest sounds great. Yes, please. I'm sorry. Some questions from Magnifico. You may have already answered this from Al's question, but if not, how on earth the item rotation works when there's more than one legacy item that's been available for 12 seasons? It's more or less like you're seeing now. It'll be, you know, the last five items. So like when we get up to season 13, it will be the last five items. Blanking on the first season item, but the first season item, and the puzzle box, right? And so there'll be seven available at a time going forward. And as I've talked about this before, but as different items hit sort of you know, goal level of enough being in the economy, they'll get knocked off. So, like, if, you know, the game completely takes off this, you know, in the 13th season, like, everybody buys puzzle boxes and the other one, then when we get to 25th season, and I'm speaking, I was talking about how I was confused earlier. I'm trying to trying to use it the way that it's labeled right now. And then when we get to the 25th season, those wouldn't necessarily make a reappearance. To the best of my knowledge, none of the items are really close to that level yet. I'd like to get, you know, in the hundreds. And I think, like, they're topping out at, like, around 100 right now. So it would be a pretty substantial jump, to see that happen. And I will definitely, like, let people know, right? So, for the moment, what'll be happening going forward from season 13 to season 24, is there'll be seven items in at a time, and then from there'll be eight items in at a time. And hopefully before we get back to, like, you know, 13 items at a time, we're knocking some of them out, right? And that'll sort of naturally keep us at a good level. For what it's worth, the plans are always to keep the most recent five. So it doesn't matter how, like, if, you know, I introduce an item and, you know, like 500 copies of it get sold, it'll still be around for at least those 5 months. But like I said, none of that's actually relevant yet. In practice, going forward, until you hear otherwise, it's six items in, including one legacy item. From, you know, a quote a year ago, 12 seasons ago, until season 12, and then season 13, it will be five, you know, the five most recent items, one from season N minus 12 and one from season N minus 24. So they're sort of in month pairs almost. Hopefully that makes sense. Since it's a special mention in the quest log, it seems like having ghouls spread to the squatter's refuge during the prom on the docks quest is significant. Goldust and I poked it as best we could, but I get the sense we fell short. How much more is lurking there? Any hints on where to look for it? I remember very little about the squatter's refuge, because there was such a long time between putting it in and actually being discovered. I don't recall having, like, an entire side quest related to the ghouls getting in there or anything like that. I think it was more just a couple of encounters sort of thing, but double check. Is the better part of Valor Conduct, like most conducts, requiring only persistence once you know what you need to do slash avoid to do to get it, or is it like True Immortal where unless you succeed consistently at tasks that aren't entirely in your control, you can fail to get it? It's not like True Immortal. It's harder if you're a fuck up. but you can't actually fuck it up, if that makes sense. it's persistence, but the level of persistence that you need scales a lot based on your success, if that makes sense. I think it does, right? Like, there's, and it's not like all of the other conducts necessarily, right? Like, most of them are just like avoid doing this thing, do this thing. This one is more. Is little the scales a little more than that. It seems like the last few unearthly items have been more about flavor and cool content than straightforward in-game power. Is this a result of a conscious effort to keep the lid on power creep and preserve design space? Is it more of a matter of just following where these ideas the item leave you? Or is there a serious power looking in unfitted aspects of these items or implications we haven't fully thought it through yet? As a whole, just go where the items want me to. I'm still sort of feeling out what we want to do with Old Town going in. Maybe not as jumping ahead with some of these. I would imagine you will see some power creep with Old Town going in, right? Just because there will be a lot more powerful items in the game, right? But what exact form that takes is still sort of an open question. I think going forward, we'll see a lot more like scaling items along the lines of the Crystal Flame, stuff like that. I've done practically everything I can think of to find new content in the second iteration of the Charnel House, fighting all the enemies of the Broken World and Degenerate Mists active, along with choosing many of the choices in the choice encounters. Is it possible to lock yourself out of finding hidden content, perhaps with an unfortunate choice of skills or knocking down dry riverbed walls? You're trivially able to lock yourself out of the second Charnel House, right? Just by shooting into the back of the head when you get the chance, right? But don't think there's anything you're really locking yourself out of within the charnel house. Obviously, again, I think trivially, you're can lock yourself out of, like, you know, the content related to some of the skills by getting different skills. But I think, I would say for the vast majority of stuff in there, like for the stuff that I think you're concerned about, you can't lock yourself out. With Serpent Pattern, I found, is there anything left to find about Serpent Venom? I think so. Yes. Yeah, there is still some stuff left to find about Serpent Venom. new side quests are always fun. Oh, sorry. Moving on to Cryptodynamic. I've been doing Mad Jam without this game. Are you missing anything significant with Goblin and Bones, or are you in a pretty good track with it? I'm pretty sure that you're on a good track with it. It's a one-coin item, so there's not, like, a, you know, endless depths of mystery. Although I did add a couple. there aren't any really giant mysteries, like, except for the thing that I added that I'm never expecting you to find. So I guess there is some stuff in there. I think whoever finds the thing that I'm talking about will be really excited, though. It's really cool. Sorry, I'm a giant jerk. And who knows, maybe somebody will find it tomorrow. It's hard to say. Is there any way to unpoison the massive clam in Lake Metroplex without resetting? Nope, some things cannot be undone. I tried giving the Bone Scepter to the Ocean King as an offering, and then capturing one of the Lesser Fae and giving them to him, just in case there might be another way of getting Blessed of the Seas. It turned out not to be, but at the cost of a skill that would have been costly to get... Blah, 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 blah. But at the cost of a skill, would it be possible to get some different text in response from the king? Unless I'm missing something anyway. It's not so much that... Yeah, I don't think they're going to get alternate texts in that, for what it's worth. since I seem to be on a run of water-related questions, we've been octopus, shark, clam, squid, eel, and a variety of fish. Any chance we'll be able to run into a lobster or crab at some point? Giant etheric versions that attempt to eat us first are perfectly acceptable. I can't specifically speak to lobster or crab, but I'd be very surprised if... nobody in my games ever runs into pistol shrimp and mantis shrimp. They're sort of more Twilight Heroes flavored at some level. But they are actual animals, which I'm going to pontificate on at length, because, you know, you're listening to my podcast, you should expect random weird biology lessons, right? So, if you're not familiar with pistol shrimp, they are kind of the coolest thing ever. They're fairly small shrimp, like 3 centimeters, 5 centimeters, so like 1 or 2 at most. And they have like one freakishly large claw. They look kind of like crayfish with one freakishly large claw. If you know you're in the, you know, crayfish parts of the world. And they what they do, you know, like, oh yeah, they got a big claw, like they grab fish with it or whatever. No, they snap it closed so fast that there's a vacuum that's temporarily collated. It's called like cavitation bubble or something like that. But an underwater vacuum, and then it just collapses and creates this shockwave that can actually be used to kill small fish, which is kind of the coolest thing ever. So like they don't hit anything with it; they just snap it closed really hard and kill fish at the distance, and like, you know, stun larger fish and stuff like that. And it's like, wow. That is fucking sweet. And for reference, it's... for the bigger ones, it's rated up to 218 decibels at the point of origin, which we're talking like shotguns, artillery blasts, like, not fucking around with levels of sound. Tiny little shrimp. And I kind of love them just because, like, in 3rd edition D&D in particular, there's the sonic damage type, and I think Twilight Heroes, which also has a sonic damage type, does a much better job with having, like, you know, sonic enemies that are not, like, I mean, more absurd than, you know, the other enemies. But 3rd edition D&D had terrible, just, like, they would introduce a sonic enemy, you'd be like, Jesus Christ, this is terrible. Like, really? Like, you expect me to put this in my game? But, like, then we've got, like, these actual natural creatures that are totally, like, all about the sonic damage, which is just sweet as hell. And one of the other things, they're in the running for, like, loudest, noisiest creature in the ocean, with, like, blue whales, sperm whales. It's like, yeah, it's like, this is the size of, like, a sperm whale's tooth. Yeah, and they, like, fuck up with sonar and all sorts of stuff. And they're not, like, terribly uncommon. You know? But anyway, yeah, that's cool. I heard pistol shrimp. And there are mantis shrimp, which are kind of like their big brothers, also called sea locusts, by the ancient Assyrians. That's actually one of the other cool things about them. So, if you're familiar with, if you follow, you know, like, I mean, even like, you know, Cracked or, you know, read Pete C. Meyer's blog or whatever, like, you will rapidly discover that there is shit in the deep parts of the ocean that is just fucking terrifying, right? Like, just not effing around. Oh, that reminds me, there is actually a really cool thing in the mind left. Anyway. But these things are just, like, you know, just chilling out, like, in relatively shallow water. Like, the mantis shrimp will live in, you know, like, coral reefs a lot of the time. And the pistol shrimp, too, which will actually, like, will form symbiotic relationships with gobies, with the little fish gobies, and, basically use them as seeing eye dogs. Like, we'll lay its antenna on the goby, and then, like, if the goby sees, you know, danger or whatever, they will go back into their shared lair, which, like, I don't know, heart. And then he uses the clicks to communicate, and all sorts of stuff. They're just ridiculous animals, seriously. Just look up pistol shrimp. They're wrong, crazy. With the mantis shrimp, they are capable of, like, similarly... they'll also get that sort of that vacuum effect going, and they will basically, and there are a couple varieties of them. Some of them will just, like, spear things, and other ones will punch things, more or less, with, like, a hard, blunt surface, and they'll shatter, like, clamshells and stuff, which is what they're doing. The spears are obviously grabbing fish, but it'll be, like, even if they... Again, in a very, like, why don't we have giant ones of these in D&D? What the fuck is wrong with you? Even if they miss a lot of times, like, the stuff that they miss will get hit with a shockwave, which is just cool. Or, like, you know, you'll get, you know, hit hard enough to, like, I'm pretty sure that they're also called thumb splitters, the mantis shrimp. But, like, hit hard enough to, you know, break a clamshell open and then get the shockwave, which is just cool. They can grow up to be, like, 15 inches long, so they can be pretty good sized. But they'll also, like, hitch rides. They're hardy enough to hitch rides when you get coral for a fish tank. Obviously not the bigger ones, thankfully, but there are instances of them just punching through the sides of, like, not like, you know, like, you know, your 10-gallon fish tank, right? In the kids' room, but, like, the big fuck-off, like, you know, security glass style, like, big saltwater tanks, right, with the sort of tank that you would put live coral in, and they'll just, like, oh, your hand looks tasty, like, punch and break the side of your fish tank, which is so fucking sweet. I mean, obviously not for the person whose fish tank just got destroyed, but it's like, wow. Nature is awesome. And since I'm talking about mantis shrimp, there are species, like, with human eyes, we have, you know, the, like, red, blue, green cones and the, you know, just intensity of the black and white rods. And there are species of mantis shrimp that they've looked at that have 16 types of photoreceptors, as opposed to our 4. And in addition to sort of like, you know, the range of colors and stuff, they find polarized light, which is kind of cool when you're underwater, because, you know, obviously, like, when the light hits the surface, especially at different times of day, it'll come down polarized, so you have a better idea of, like, what your depth is and where you are, stuff like that. And also circularly polarized light, which is just weird as shit. It's one of those things that's like, that does not really, like, I follow polarized light and circularly polarized light, which is just like a light polarized through a rotating filter, basically. And they're not really 100% sure last time I checked what they use that for, but they're like, this could actually be kind of handy. Circle cryptids are kind of sea urchins, he's like that too, but I'd have to double check. Anyway, okay, so sea life aside, don't get me started on vampire squid or something. It'll just go downhill. But anyway, I was running into those recently, and I was just like, you know, like, such a great, you know, like, for everyone who's ever played D&D, like, you know, there are all these, like, you know, giant animals, you know, you fight, like, giant crabs, giant fucking crayfish, giant, you know, boars and rats and wolves and, you know, every imaginable kind of giant animal, and then the third edition, trying to support, you know, the sonic damage type, because they've got, like, you know, fire, ice, electric, acid, sonic. I think that's all of them from third edition. They added psychic, clearly, you know, copying off of Twilight Heroes for fourth edition. But they clearly. Oh, and they added like necrotic and radiant. So maybe that joke's less funny because I actually added a bunch of other ones too. But I will still make fun of them. But yeah, they're trying to support the sonic damage type. But it's like, you've got all these giant animals and all these, like, crazy sonic creatures that are just terrible. And, like, never the twain met. So, yeah, if you're writing a third-party product for, you know, Pathfinder 3rd Edition D&D, I demand stats for giant pistol shrimp and mantis shrimp. That's your, you know, moral obligation now. Okay, I'm actually done. Read any good books lately? Actually, I've been reading a lot. Been sort of reading quite a few role-playing books. I've gonna have a new Pathfinder game starting up in not too long, did the 5th edition playtest. Did some playtesting for that for 5th edition D&D. That was pretty interesting. It harkens back to the way I actually kind of like my D&D, which is, it's sort of funny. They have sort of, like, through all the editions of D&D, and, like, everybody who, you know, plays D&D obviously has, like, their favorite edition, right? And, like, but they're putting out the playtest, and, personally, I'm actually, like, a not fucking around, like, original edition D&D fan. Like, you know, basic set, rule encyclopedia, which admittedly is not actually, like, original, right? The basic set's not actually original, but whatever. Close enough to fool people, right? And then they released the 5th edition playtest, and it has, like, a lot of elements that are very much, like, the playtest document is set in the Caves of Chaos, right? Like, the module from the original, from the basic set, right? B2, Keep on the Borderlands. And, like, there's a lot of other stuff. They're just very basic-y feeling. But obviously, like, I'm, you know, an old-timer at this point, and all of the, you know, the youngins on the internet are all like, oh, this feels like, you know, combination of 3rd and 4th edition. It's like, no, not really so much. It kind of feels like they're actually... I will give them credit, actually, a great deal of credit, for doing what they basically said they were going to do, which is, yeah, we're just going to kind of take all the editions of D&D and throw them into a blender and hit frappe. And see what comes out. And that's very much what it feels like. And so, like, there are sort of... because a lot of the simplicity of, like, you know, pre-advanced Dungeons & Dragons and, you know, first edition, second edition are sort of in there, it makes, it ends up feeling very different from 3rd and 4th. And they're approaching, like, magical fantasy land where, you know, like, the rules are as simple as old... OD&D is what people call it sometimes, but, you know, the rules are as simple as the rule cycle be, but the character customization is, you know, more 3rd edition-ish, and the monsters work a lot like 4th edition, which is kind of like... And I mean this not derogatorily at all, but work a lot like World of Warcraft monsters, and World of Warcraft actually is pretty good, like, especially when we're talking about, like, bosses and stuff. It's certainly better, better design than, like, 3rd edition D&D, so, like, that's not a diss. World of Warcraft did not completely, like, almost annihilate tabletop gaming because it was terrible, right? It's a well-designed game. It doesn't mean that you have to like it or play it. But, yeah, if they create this magical conglomeration, I might actually have to buy it. But, for the meantime, sticking with Pathfinder. So I've been reading a lot of Pathfinder books, and, you know, the playtest docs for 5e, and, you know, getting nostalgic and going back. And this is just weird. I was, since the playtest document is Case of Chaos, right, like, I was like, oh, you know, like, this is the exact same map I should pull up. I'll keep on the Borderlands so that I don't have to, you know, reference back and forth to the map and PDF, because that's just a pain in the ass. And I, you know, get out my copy of... I'm looking for my copy of Keeping the Borderlands, and it's like... And it was actually in the box sets, which were on a different shelf, but I was flipping through, and it's like, oh, I have a copy of the Isle of Dread. Like, that's... It's like the classic D&D wilderness module, right? And probably much like Keep on the Borderlands doesn't really stand up to modern standards, but it's sort of like a nostalgic piece. And I'm like, I honestly had no idea that I had a copy of this adventure. Like, well, that's cool. I should read that at some point. Put it back on the shelf. Like, look at the next book, and it's like, I have another copy of the Isle of Dread. Like, what? I have no idea how that happened. Yeah, I had a ton of, like, not only, I mean, I have a lot of, you know, old, you know, original D&D and, like, second edition stuff that I knew that I had. But then I was going through and I was like, I don't recognize, like, half these modules. Like, I just don't know where they came from. And, like, I have a bunch of Spelljammer box sets that I'm kind of like, I don't remember ever owning these box sets. But that's fine, because Spelljammer's amazing. So, you know, who knows, my next Pathfinder game may, you know, involve flying space sailing ships. So, hey. Anyway, role playing aside, I've also been like reading a lot, and I'm about to pick up the Arcanum, which looks really interesting. Might be terrible. I don't know. Like I said, I haven't actually read it yet, but it's literally sitting like right over there where I can see it. So I'm thinking about it. It's like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, H.P. Lovecraft, Marie Laveau, and one other person, I'm blanking, team up to fight crime. Like, you can't really go wrong with that. Might be like, I don't know, Tesla or somebody. That's who I'd put in there. It doesn't matter if the time frame actually works out. Let's see. Oh, Harry Houdini. Ah, sorry. Yeah, that's totally a gimme. If you're writing, like, alternate history fiction with H.P. Lovecraft, you kind of have to team up with Harry Houdini. I'm not sure how many people have actually read Entombed with the Pharaohs is one title, and I think Beneath the Pyramids is the other. But there's a H.P. Lovecraft story with Houdini, which is just, it's just fun. Like, it's, there's not a lot of Lovecraft that's like, I don't know, like, just, yeah, good, clean fun. But I feel like that one qualifies. Anyway, yeah, the, so, there's that, and I, read, gonna totally forget the series with the two British guys' names, which is just not helpful. It's, so I've probably mentioned a couple times that my wife works in the secular movement, atheism, etc., etc. And there is another group in the secular movement called Center for Inquiry, CFI, and they own a publishing company called Prometheus Press that they, for years and years and years, have been using to, you know, just print out, like, you know, like, here are my thoughts about atheism, because, you know, atheists love producing books. It's sort of a problem. it's a problem that we have. We need to go through, like, a 12-step program where, you know, the first step is not acknowledging the existence of a higher power, I guess. I was looking at, I was at the library, which I actually spend a lot of time at our library. I hope I have raved about our library before, because I'm going to skip that part this time. And I was looking at the back of this book, and I was like, Pyr, like P-Y-R, an imprint of Prometheus Press. And I'm like, what are the chances there are two Prometheus Presses? Like, that seems weird. And so it was At the Mountains of the Moon was the one that I actually picked up. It's The Adventures of Somebody and Somebody. I'm blanking on both of their names, but, like, yeah, totally the same people. So, apparently, like, this organization that has, like, a press that I am familiar with has, like, developed this, like, sci-fi fantasy imprint that I was just not aware of at all. But yeah, I read, this is gonna bother me. There we go. Mountains of the Moon, Mountains of the Moon, Mountains of the Moon. Expedition to the Mountains of the Moon. Book. Eh? No. There we go. Burton and Swinburne. Which are actual, like, people. But it's a really weird series of, it's a trilogy of books. It's very strange. Mountains of the Moon is actually the third one, which I discovered to do my great confusion. I have this horrible tendency to get a book and from the library, just like grab something off the shelf and look at it very intently. Be like, okay, this doesn't mention any of the books, doesn't say it's like second or third book in a series, get it home and find out that it's the second or third book in the series. So I've gotten to the point where I'm like looking through the stacks and I'll be like, okay, I'm looking at this book. It looks interesting. I'll check it and I'll be like, okay, it's actually the first book in a series. I can pick it out. Burton and Swinburne. It's very like, very well-researched alternate history fiction sort of Victorian explorer and Victorian poet steampunk adventure. With time travel. I'm not sure if I would call it good exactly, but it was definitely interesting enough to be worth reading. And I grabbed another pair of books from them that are more like Weird West steampunk type thing. I've read quite a few. Let's see, The Cloud Roads I read recently. It's like The Cloud Roads and The Serpent Sea. Those were pretty interesting. I will admit, I read through, pretty sure it's Cloud Roads is the name of the first book. Read through the entire book, expecting it to become terrible at some point. Like, I was like, okay, I'll read this chapter, but when it becomes terrible, I'm just gonna, you know, not bother to finish it. But it just actually just became terrible. It actually just ended up being pretty good. But it's sort of like a very, like, you know, coming-of-age tale of someone who's been, you know, ostracized by society. And it's just like, oh, God, again? But it actually did end up turning out to be pretty good. Let's see, I'm not sure if I mentioned the MythOS series. Mythos, but with OS, because it's about myths and computers, but it's got sort of a cyberpunk code monkey thing going on, like cyberpunk hacking, but like the sort of instead of like megacorps, you have the, like, you know, big sysadmin people are the Fates from Greek mythology, which is just, it's an interesting series. It's sort of young adult, so fairly light read. You can just tear through them. There's like five or six. And the series is done, as far as I can tell, so that's always nice, right? Like, you don't have to reread it when the next book comes out. Let's see. Yeah, I don't think I've read anything really life-altering recently. I read some books on comic books, because I've been sort of refamiliarizing myself with the genre, because I've read a lot of comic books, read about a lot of comic books in my youth. I had, like, half of the Marvel Encyclopedia, and just read it ridiculous. Like, I had more pages of Marvel Encyclopedia than actual comics, so I had this, like, no pun intended, encyclopedic knowledge of all these comic book characters, like, in random letters, right? Like, if you started with, like, the second half of S or T, I knew about you, but if you started with the first half of S, no idea, right? So, like, Storm, I knew all sorts of stuff about, but, like, Satana wasn't Marvel, but, like, blanking on even the names of any of them, but, like, if you're, you know, superhero names started with, I mean, I think Satan actually showed up, I'm not sure if he had an entry. Yeah, if you started off like SA, not happening. Like, no idea who you even were. And I might even have the letter distinctions broken up wrong, but it was just, it was absurd. Like, I would, like, half of the Marvel Universe I was really familiar with, the other half it wasn't. But it wasn't broken up by series, it was just alphabetical. But yeah, and I had like half a dozen. Not half a dozen, like, maybe 2 dozen comic books. Again, totally random. It was like, you know, the issue after Professor X dies fighting Legion. And that was it. The X-Men comic. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Liz has a bunch of comics. But I've been refamiliarizing myself with sort of the genre and the way that comics are created. Because I've been, you know, doing some of my background stuff for Twilight Heroes. And let's see, I've been reading a lot of, like, pulp. Robert Silverberg, is that his name? Yes. Wow. That's a really young picture of him. Okay, yeah, okay. I just Googled his name to make sure I was getting it right. Like, you know, this guy with, like, you know, black hair with, like, a little bit of gray. But he's been around for, like, ever and ever and ever. So, yeah, the other pictures of him were, like, you know, dude with white hair. It's like, all right, that's the right guy. But yeah, like, I read a bunch of his pulp stuff. And then sort of got into his more modern science fiction, and I like pulp. Pulp is good. Reading some Dick also. Yeah, I'm 12, but, like, there's just a lot of, I'm sort of trying to fill out, the checkboxes on my, you know, classic sci-fi and cyberpunk stuff, because there's, it might sound strange, you know, playing Metroplexity, I don't know, maybe it's really obvious if you've read a lot of science fiction, but my my familiarity with the cyberpunk genre is not actually, like, incredibly deep. I like the intersection a lot between sort of cyberpunk and, you know, magic, as I'm sure I've discussed endlessly on my various podcasts. But I'm coming at it very much from, like, the fantasy direction. So I'm not coming to it from the, you know, Snow Crash, Neuromancer, Do Androids Dream of Electronic Sheep, which, you know, admittedly is purely on the cyberpunk side, but I'm not coming at it from that direction at all. I'm actually coming at it from, like, the cyberpunk stuff, I think, provides a really interesting backdrop for what's going on in magic, because, like, I don't know, the sort of generic fantasy settings, I mean, they just feel overdone to a large extent, and don't offer the same sort of... I'm not going to say they don't offer the same opportunities, but they require a lot more work to really connect in the same way that a near-future setting does. Feeling sort of the traditional fantasy settings don't really connect in the same way. I mean, they're fine for game worlds. And, like, you can draw people in. It just takes, like, 10 times as much effort. And setting stuff in modern setting, I feel, is not bad by any means, but that well has sort of been poisoned to some extent. But near-future stuff, in addition to not, like, having, you know, Twilight peeing in your pool, is also also just has a lot of emotional resonance. So it's almost, it's just from a, you know, almost a storytelling perspective. So it's like those setting elements, like just the really basic cyberpunk setting elements, which I feel are, I mean, really a just what people expected to happen from the 80s. Which is why it's sort of almost retro cyberpunk at some level. Actually, I find older periods' views of the future to be fascinating. And this comes up sort of a couple of times in Metroplexity where they talk about, like, retrofuturism. But I find that that's interesting from now as well, right? Like, you know, this is what the 80s thought the future was going to look like, and this is sort of what now thinks the future is going to look like, and how that shifts through time is really interesting. Like, you know, how did the 50s think the future is going to look? How did the 60s, how did the 70s, how did the 80s, how did the 90s, how does, you know, the aughts, so to speak, how does now? And I feel like, I mean, to some degree, it's this sort of, you know, I mean, intentionally skewing dark, right? But I feel like there's sort of a trajectory there that's reasonable. But also it's sort of taken from an arc, like, you know, there's sort of, there are elements of, like, you know, like, I feel that Zaibatsu in particular is very sort of 80s cyberpunk, right? Like, the Japanese are rising, they're going to take over the universe because, like, you know, right now they are on the rise, right? And obviously that's going to continue indefinitely, and, you know, they'll take over everything, as opposed to, you know, what actually happened with, you know, the Lost Decade and so forth. But, yeah, but Zaibatsu sort of, you know, represents that to some degree. And you also have, you know, the sort of, I mean, I think that there was a stream of, I mean, I think that, this is very broad strokes, obviously, but, like, you know, 80s cyberpunk, you sort of have this more dystopian sort of feel. And I should say, like, in, I mean, this is a very American sort of thing, right? Because it's kind of weird because, like, the 80s, I guess, are remembered as a very upbeat in some ways. Like, I think that the 80s in general are sort of upbeat, but I feel like the cyberpunk of the year is almost portraying that as fiddling while Rome burns. And then you get into the 90s, and I think you get more into a almost, I mean, not like, you know, 50s futurism, but like, I think that their picture of the future is more like actually legitimately upbeat. Like, you know, everything's actually going to be good going forward. And then, you know, you sort of get the more recent, like, I mean, the resurgent in almost, like, post-apocalyptic doom and gloom since Metroplex 2's launched. I haven't, you know, really worked that in because we've got plenty of post-apocalyptic doom and gloom to go around. Yeah, it's actually just, I don't know, I find that fascinating. And I'm sort of going back and... And I understand all of it in broad strokes, but I really, I've seen a lot of that through secondary medium, right? Like, you know, movies, games, and so forth. Going a lot back to the original sources, especially, I feel that, this is going to sound sort of weird, but I feel like, in a lot of ways, creating something original is, like, if you want to be a good writer, you have to read a lot, right? And if you want to be a good, you know, setting creator, you need to learn a lot about all sorts of different settings, all of these, like, you know, tools of the trade things. But if you, I feel that there's a point where you almost know too much about the works in a genre to effectively create your own niche. Sounds kind of weird, right? But, or, you know, maybe this makes sense to everyone else too, and I'm just saying something really obvious. But it feels like now that I've sort of carved out, you know, Metroplexity's chunk of cyberpunk, and that's stable and sort of there, I feel more comfortable exposing myself to other works in the genre, and other worlds in the genre, and letting them, like, at the point where you have your own thing, it's easier to let stuff inform your world without, you know, letting that get lost, letting, you know, the spark of your world get lost. But yeah, there's a lot of what people say is the best cyberpunk I don't find even particularly palatable. But same thing happened with fantasy. Like, I'm sure a lot of people actually share this experience, but, like, you know, Tolkien is sort of considered the father of modern fantasy, and I don't... I could not finish Lord of the Rings for the longest time. I've tried at least 4 or 5 different times, and it was just like, and sometimes, like, I got halfway through Two Towers, and sometimes I got, like, partway through Fellowship, and one time I remember picking it up and, like, starting reading at page one of Fellowship, and you hit Concerning Hobbits right away, right? And it's like, fuck this, like, this is just not gonna fly. What I would actually finally got me through it was actually reading Silmarillion first, and actually getting some of the context for, like, when he starts talking about, like, oh, there's this hill and this important thing happened on the hill, and you're like, Jesus fucking Christ, just get back to the story. And you've read the Silmarillion, it's like, oh, that thing, okay, yeah, no, that totally, that clicks, and becomes actually part of the world. Anyway, that wasn't actually the point I was trying to make. The point was that, like, as a giant geek, and as a giant fantasy geek, and as a giant gaming geek, like, there's sort of a expectation that you like Tolkien, and, like, I even now, like, I don't feel like he was actually a very good writer in a lot of senses, at least compared to what we're doing now. I mean, like, you know, you always have to give props to, like, you know, Ada Lovelace, right? Because, you know, she's, like, the first programmer. And, like, even if, like, what she was doing was sort of, like, you know, not... was so basic we barely even recognize it anymore, right? I mean, yeah, like, you still have to give props, but, like, you're not gonna go back over her code, right? Like, she's just like, oh, hey, you know, good job, like, starting the thing that, like, is really cool now. But, yeah, I feel like his work as a world builder still sort of informs us to a large degree. Like other world builders, even folks who don't want to go to, you know, his sort of, his approach. I think that he has an approach that is sort of, even if you don't like it, has definitely, you know, has stood the test of time. But, like, I just, his writing and I do not get along. Anyway. Okay. So, I probably actually even forgot some books that I've read recently. I've been reading a lot of books. And like I said, refamiliarizing myself with that. Both, you know, the superhero genre and cyberpunk. And of course, you know, when I see Avengers, Cabin in the Woods. Both of which were quite good. Cabin in the Woods, actually, sort of tangenting from books, because God knows we haven't gotten enough out of tangent yet. Cabin in the Woods was actually... I'm not a big horror fan as far as movies go. I feel that I would almost rather read, like, the Wikipedia page on a horror movie than watch a horror movie. Because I feel like almost every horror movie, or at least, like, every, even, like, really the terrible ones, tend to have, like, a good idea at their core. But then the implementation of that idea is very rote once you have the idea. And, like, I don't need to see the rote part, right? Like, I just want the fucking idea. So I'll go to, you know, the Wikipedia page or the IMDb or whatever, which, I mean, is sort of blasphemous, right? If you like horror, like, if you like what they're doing. And I don't. I find it honestly kind of boring. Which, you know, you're welcome to say about the stuff that I like, too. It's just not my thing. But Cabin in the Woods, actually, I mean, I hate to say shit like, you know, was a deconstruction of the tropes of the horror genre. But holy fuck, like, if you're saying that about a movie, I feel like, you know, if you have to say things like that, I think that, you know, Cabin in the Woods is a really good movie to say stuff like that about. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And I would suggest that if either, you know, you like deconstructions, you like horror movies, and don't mind them being deconstructed, or if you just really love Joss Whedon, which is, you know, all the reason why I think a lot of people need, you should go see it. It's really interesting. It's got kind of, you know, Cthulhu vibe going on, which is, important. But an interesting sort of, you know, deconstruction of the Cthulhu vibe. So, that was good. And Avengers was just, you know, fun. Although, I will admit, as a long-standing, you know, comic book dweeb, and a person whose tastes in fiction, I've realized fairly recently, like, just, like, deeply shaped by Deep Space Nine, having the Chitauri in there, and having them not be shapeshifters, I don't know, like, I'm not offended from, like, a canon perspective, like, whatever, right, like, do whatever you want. Chitauri, the Skrull, by the way, for other old school folks, they were in my books, but they weren't called that back then. That was, I think, I Ultimates thing. They were called the Chitauri. But anyway. But it feels like... I was just sort of like, yay, Avengers, finally get it. Was like a solid capstone to, you know, all of the stuff that had been leading up to it. I felt like they did a really good job with that. But as an individual movie standing alone, it didn't really have, like, a very good twist. Like, there was no, like, you know, second act, third act twist, right? Like, that transition just sort of, like, like, there's sort of, like, two acts rather than three, almost, because there wasn't that break point. Unless you count, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. betraying them, which is... Sorry, that was totally a spoiler. Spoiler! But, yeah. But I think that it's, it felt like the movie needed some sort of twist there, and my abiding love for shapeshifter infiltration stories, which I'm totally positive in retrospect dates back to DS9, and my and the fact that, like, you have the Chitauri there / the Skrull there. And they're like, that's their whole thing, right? Like, they're not bruisers, they're shape-shifting infiltrators. And it would be like having a Star Trek movie and having, like, the changelings and, like, killing a bunch of them, which is fine, whatever. Like the episode of DS9 where they sort of carpet bomb the Change of Home World, or, you know, whatever. or at the very least, you know, that's what they think is going on. There aren't, you know, the infiltration, et cetera, aspects. All right. Even if there weren't, like, at least then, like, you know, whatever is going on in the plot is going on, but, like, the fact that there's this changeling infiltration that needs to be filled, and the changeling infiltrator's over here, and it's just like, why? So yeah, my wife kind of ruined the adventures for me by pointing out that they needed a twist, and I was already sort of like, that's kind of weird that Chitauri are here, and they're not shape-shifting at all. Yeah. Okay. Whew. All right. Actually going to the last question, which is good, because Have you read any good books lately? I'm sorry, Crypto. I think that you may have caused the longest tangent ever. Throwing a random unearthly idea out there. Have you considered doing anything based on the case of Charles Dexter Ward? We already heard about samples from fallen foes, bind their essence with mirrors, and capture their souls in a book. So calling people and creatures from their essential souls might not be too far fetched. It would not surprise me to see something inspired by that. I would probably not expect an unearthly item. I would expect perhaps a run-in with someone... with someone referencing that sort of, you know, chunk of the mythos. I might not have quite enough, like, side etheric areas to do that quite yet, because we kind of, you know, we have, like, Lovecraft and, you know, nautical zombies. Original zombies, because, you know, we liked zombies before they were cool. That's me making fun of myself for being a zombie hipster. Just so we're cool. Now I'm thinking about zombie hipsters. That's just kind of awesome.
I would expect, that would not be a bad unearthly item, but I would expect that more along the lines of as someone like the artist. And that weird, weird, weird anime. Jesus Christ. So, I'm not sure if I mentioned this. This is just scarring. There's an anime. Came out a year or two ago in Japan. Got translated and simulcast. More or less simulcast over here. That was like...
I cannot remember the name of it, but it can't be too hard to find. I want to say it had Charles Dexter Ward in it as a character, but I could be totally off base. It definitely had the Reanimator, who was just weird. But it's like the... It was... Like, so it, of course, has giant robots, which, okay, whatever, you know, like, and then, like, all the characters are sort of, like, loosely based on Lovecraft characters. And then, but, like, to activate the giant robots, they have, quote, spell books, which, of course, instead of being, like, spell books, right, like, books of spells, they are, like, little lolly goth girls, right? Gothic Lolita, what's sort of like the creepy girl in the Happy Hour, and like I watched like 6 episodes of this straight, and then was like, I can't even handle this anymore, and stopped, which is good for my sanity. But they have like, you know, like the Necronomicon Lolligoth and the Al-Azif Lolligoth, and the probably the, you know, the Cultist School Lolligoth. And, like, you know, giant robots. And it was just really, like, it wasn't, like, you know, defiling Lovecraft or anything. Which, I mean, I'm sure that people might disagree on that. But that wasn't why it bugged me. It was just so fucking weird. And I say that having watched a lot of just really out there stuff. And I guess not even weird. It was just almost like incoherent might actually be a better word. Like, weird gives it this sort of gravitas, right? And that it, I'm not sure it actually deserves that at all. But yeah, that was really strange. It might be called something like Necronomicon or Lovecraft. I don't know, but yeah. Okay. So, yeah. That's just strange. Okay. That's... that's where we stand. So, we started out discussing how I was sort of on a big picture kick, and how I was open to suggestions for little side quests. So, I think... There is definitely some content I could add in. There's a couple of like fixes and updates I want to do, and so we'll get some of those in. And I guess I don't think anyone really put forward any, but we had some votes for Side Quests Are Awesome and a vote for Andrea, because everyone loves Andrea. So I guess that's probably the direction I will go in. And yeah, there's a... And then, of course, I'll be back on the event, which hopefully will... be unveiled in all of its spectacular glory. I think the people will really like it. It's just one of those things where I need to make sure that I can make it simple enough to actually get implemented this year, along with, you know, Halloween and Christmas and Old Town. Because if I can't do that, I'm not going to do it, right? Like, getting Old Town out is more important. And worst case scenario, it gets folded into Halloween. So, I've got a little bit of side stuff that I'll be doing, and getting some various fixes. I hope you enjoyed listening to me ramble for like 2 hours now that I check on it. Probably mostly about, you know, mantis shrimp and books, but hopefully you now feel, you know, edified about mantis shrimp and books, because fucking mantis shrimp, and, you know, books.
some of which were pretty good.
Yep, so thanks for listening, and thanks for playing. Thanks for donating very much. I know that we've hit sort of a lull in content, and I'm working to well, make it less lull-seeming, right? It's just a matter of, you know, dropping a little bit here and there, which I will get back to doing. And yeah. Thanks for sending in some questions, and I will get this posted before you listen to it, thereby getting to me talking about getting it posted. Thanks. Have a good one.